Nicholas finally appeared after the first batter, casually strolling through the 97th Street entrance.
Nicholas!
Laura shouted as he sauntered past them. Over here!
Get out there!
She directed him, pointing to the field.
They already started.
Go, Charlotte!
Margaret yelled when it was her daughter's turn at bat.
Knock it out of the park!
Charlotte made contact on the first swing. The ball soared up and over to where Emma stood staring at the ground looking for four-leaf clovers.
Emma!
Everyone screamed. Laura winced as the ball came down. Had Emma been a few yards to the right, it would have hit her in the head. It took Emma a moment to snap out of her dreamy stupor and notice the ball. And then, another to realize she was supposed to get it. After placing the ball in her mitt, she reached behind to pick a wedgie. Then she took the ball back out of the mitt and threw it with such exertion that she lost her balance and fell forward on her knees.
Home run!
Margaret whooped as Charlotte rounded the bases. All too soon came the moment Laura had been dreading, Emma's turn up at bat. Emma swung and missed, swung and missed, swung and missed.
Three strikes means you're out,
someone hollered as Emma positioned herself for a fourth attempt.
Is that the case with T-ball?
Laura spoke up.
Only three tries?
Everyone looked at Tripp, the class father, who once again appeared flustered by his authority.
Laura's right, Margaret announced. In T-ball, each child gets as many turns as it takes to hit the ball.
When Emma finally made contact with the ball, the ripple of excitement was followed by a silence, which Laura realized she was expected to fill.
Yay, Emma! She called out, good job hitting the ball.
Don't forget to run,
she added a moment later as Emma stood by home plate wearing a sour expression and staring at her thumb.
Quick, darling! Run to first base!
As Emma continued to stand there, others joined in.
Run! 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 They yelled.
Now Emma looked irritated.
When I hit the ball hit my thumb, she shouted back.
There were no visible indications of a thumb injury, but Emma insisted the pain was too much to continue playing, and joined Laura on the island of blankets with the other mothers.
You were supposed to cheer for me, Emma said bitterly, taking a seat on Laura's lap.
I was cheering, Laura whispered back. Did you not hear me? I was saying, yay, Emma, good job, run.
You weren't cheering, Mom,
Emma's body stiffened.
You were talking to me in a normal voice.
I agree, Emma, Margaret chimed in from a few feet away. Your mom could work on her projection.
Do you know about projecting?
Emma shook her head glumly.
Projection is, Margaret got on her knees to demonstrate. It's when you take a deep breath and really belt out your words like you're shouting from the rooftops to make sure everyone can hear you.
Margaret had a shrill voice to begin with. Laura winced. Emma smiled with amusement. The inning ended, but Emma refused to join her teammates in the field.
My thumb, she whimpered. It really hurts.
Nicholas came over, tapped Laura on the shoulder, and mouthed,
If she's out for the game, should I stay?
I think it's over soon, Laura whispered. Do you need to be somewhere?
It's a difficult day for Stephanie, he whispered back, having lost her father.
Laura was confused. As far as she knew, Stephanie's father was very much alive and well.
Mike?
Nicholas shook his head sadly.
Mike's just her stepfather. Her real dad died when she was just a baby.
Laura knew she should drop the matter, but she couldn't help herself. How old was Stephanie when Mike arrived on the scene?
A kid, was Nicholas's answer.
What age?
Two.
So Stephanie's biological father was dead, but she wasn't exactly fatherless. For all intents and purposes, Mike was her father. She even called him Dad. To make a fuss about Father's Day seemed a little emotionally immature.
You should leave, Laura told Nicholas. Go be with her. I'll stay a little longer.
No, really, it's okay. Leave, I insist.
I'll stay for another inning, he said with conviction.
The inning ended, but Nicholas did not leave. He stayed for the remainder of the game, and then stuck around after to participate in the father-daughter group photo.
Summer again. Their first morning in Ushant, Emma disappeared after breakfast, declaring beforehand that she was allowed to explore on her own now that she was 6. Laura consented so long as she didn't set foot in the ocean. An hour passed, and Laura was still reading the paper when she came back in.
Mom, when you're done with the newspaper, you better come outside. There's a mystery I have to show you.
A mystery, Laura repeated with half-hearted inflection.
Not the good kind, Emma said cryptically.
Laura followed Emma down a path that led to a little inlet by the shore.
You're not gonna believe it, Emma said as they arrived at the end of the path.
Hands on hips, she shook her head and surveyed the premises. It took Laura a moment to realize what she was supposed to be reacting to, the absence of a small body of water that used to be there.
Your pond, Laura said. Emma's pond is gone. Is it because of acid rain? Emma wanted to know.
No, it's a natural thing, Laura reassured her. Some years it's here, some years it isn't.
But what happened to it?
The shoreline shifted and now it's an inlet.
What's an inlet? Emma asked.
It's what it is now. A private spot where you can go to read a book or watch the sunset. I know you're sad about the pond, but to tell you the truth, I think this is even better. Emma's Inlet, you can call it.
But why did it happen?
Emma looked skeptical, mildly suspicious.
The word for it is erosion, Laura explained as they walked back to the house.
That means very small changes over time. It has to do with the tides and currents, storms and winds and waves. You'll learn about it in science class.
But Emma wasn't listening.
Emma's Inlet, she was saying. Emma's Inlet.
Emma and Charlotte had been playmates since they were little, and as first graders at Winthrop, they announced they were best friends. The elevation of their self-declared friendship status was something in which Emma took great pride.
Teachers are always trying to break us apart. Other girls are always trying to join in. But it doesn't work. We're best friends.
The friendship had its volatile moments. There were fights, which led to accusations, which became character assassination campaigns in which their classmates took sides. Though the two girls were thrilled to see each other upon arriving at school each morning, it was not uncommon that Laura and Margaret would arrive at pickup to find the union bitterly dissolved. Laura and Margaret refused to get involved, but this didn't stop the girls from trying to solicit their support.
I wish Charlotte would stop lying and bragging, Emma said when Laura picked her up from school one day.
A few feet away, Charlotte greeted Margaret.
The thing about Emma is that she has to be the center of everything, and she's a liar.
As the girls carried on their mutual recriminations, their classmates rallied around them and chimed in, echoing the sentiments of whichever girl they decided to ally themselves with. It was painfully obvious to Laura that these girls wanted to be Emma and Charlotte's friends, but that the duo had no interest in them except as pawns in situations like this. Tomorrow morning, Emma and Charlotte would be exclusive again, the classmates cast aside until the next conflict arose. How Emma and Charlotte had come to occupy the top rung on the social ladder of their first-grade class was a mystery to Laura. Was it a fluke, or an indication of some kind of innate social fitness that would ultimately prove to be a Darwinian asset? In either case, Laura was not proud. Far from it. She didn't like how Emma and Charlotte conducted themselves. It wasn't a good way to treat people or operate in the world. That evening, she called Margaret to discuss the matter. Growing up, the two of them had not been part of the in-crowd, and she was sure Margaret would share her concerns. She did not.
Girls will be girls.
You can't play God in these situations. The next morning, as was always the case, all ill feelings were forgotten when the girls encountered each other outside the entrance to school.
Charlotte! Emma!
An urgent, hysterical embrace morphed into a do-si-do. Giddy laughter ensued. Laura and Margaret stood off to the side, watching the dramatic reunion.
It's like they hadn't expected to see each other, Laura remarked with amusement, as though this were some kind of miraculous coincidence.
Margaret started to say something in response to this, then fell silent. Her chin dimpled and rose. A single tear fell down her left cheek.
Mags, Laura said, resting a hand on her arm. Is something wrong?
Margaret shook her head and smiled. I'm fine. She wiped her eyes and blinked. Composed, she waved goodbye to Charlotte and headed down the block. Laura walked after her.
Please tell me what's upsetting you, she said when they'd turned the corner. You know you can tell me anything.
What you said about the girls. How it's like they hadn't expected to see each other, as though it were a coincidence.
Margaret's eyes welled up with fresh tears. She pulled a Kleenex from her purse.
It reminded me of this feeling I get when I go check on Charlotte in the middle of the night. I sit on the edge of her bed, watching her sleeping, just thinking how random it is, of all the babies up for adoption in America, that I got her.
And she got you, Laura added.
To think, Margaret continued, we could have been strangers, living in the same city, even if Staten Island is a world apart.
Laura tried to imagine this other version of Charlotte. There were certain fundamental characteristics one was born with. Charlotte would still be Charlotte, but she would dress and speak differently. Her favorite food wouldn't be smoked salmon. She would grow up with different expectations of life. But here she was now, perfectly at home, an Upper East Sider to the bone. Emma's class was instructed to bring a paper bag lunch to school that day, as they would be going on a field trip over the lunch hour. Their destination was a short walk down Fifth Avenue, St. Christopher's School for Boys. After filing into the lobby, Miss Russell led the girls down a flight of stairs and into a gymnasium. Dressed in khakis, blazers, and ties, the boys stood in a single-file line on the other side of the room. Normally, when they spotted each other in the park or crossed paths on the street, there were whispers and snickers, and maybe a taunt. Today was a new and different kind of occasion, and the dread and embarrassment it generated was palpable. As the two groups of first graders shuffled across the rubber floor to meet in the middle, the buzz of the fluorescent lights grew louder. Each Winthrop girl was to be paired with a St. Christopher's boy. Students were called up one at a time, and after being assigned to each other, they had to shake hands and introduce themselves. Miss Russell and the boys' teacher demonstrated how this was done. Emma's lunch date introduced himself as Teddy. He came up to her chin.
"Where do you want to sit?" Teddy asked, eyes darting around the room.
"You can pick," Emma told him.
After a moment of puffing his cheeks out and tapping a finger on his upper lip in theatrical deliberation, Teddy swaggered off. Emma followed as he lapped the room, his hair swinging behind him like a bowl that was about to fall off his head. Eventually, everyone was sitting but them.
"Teddy," his teacher called as he continued to walk around the room. "Is there a problem?"
"Looking for a place to sit," he shouted.
"What's wrong with where you are?"
Teddy shrugged and plopped on the floor. As Emma took a seat across from him, he made a face and covered his eyes.
"Your underpants are showing," he said.
"That's not my underwear," Emma clarified. "That's my bloomers. It's part of our uniform."
She wanted to smooth the skirt of her tunic down so that it covered her crotch, but feared doing so might counter the impression of what she'd just told him.
"What the heck?"
Teddy's shoulders drooped in disappointment as he pulled a sandwich out of his bag.
"She knows I hate brown bread."
Miss Russell and the other teacher circulated around the gym. Sensing his teacher's proximity,
Teddy reached into the pocket of his blazer and removed a flashcard, which he proceeded to read from as he chewed.
If you could be an animal, any animal, what kind of animal would you be?
A person, Emma said, and before Teddy could reject this answer, she added, a person is an animal.
Teddy didn't say anything, but his face turned pink and he started blinking a lot. When this continued, Emma got nervous and raised her hand to summon a teacher's attention.
I think he's choking, she told Miss Russell.
Teddy shook his head no and held up a finger.
A little bit of spit went down the wrong pipe, he explained in a slow, whispery gasp, wiping away tears.
Having fully recovered, Teddy answered his own question.
I'd be a Vampirotuthis Infernalis. You probably don't even know what that is. It's a vampire squid. It can make itself invisible. It can turn its body into a light that confuses its enemy.
Done with their sandwiches, it was time to exchange desserts. Emma pushed a saran-wrapped brownie across the floor toward Teddy, who tossed a small red box in her direction. It landed near her foot with a rattle. On the front of the box was a drawing of a woman in a bonnet holding a basket full of grapes. Emma took pride in being a child who would try anything and eat everything. But there was one exception, raisins, which had the leathery skin of a cockroach and were also the same color. As she pondered her predicament, there was a piercing scream on the other end of the gym. Charlotte lay on her back, kicking her legs up in the air like she was riding an upside-down bicycle.
Yes! Yes! Oh, my God, yes!
As the screaming and scissor-kicking continued, Miss Russell walked very fast in her direction. Before she could get to her, Charlotte popped back up into sitting position and thrust her hand in the air to show everyone the reason for her excitement. Sour straws that her lunch date had brought. Charlotte loved sour straws. They all did. Standing up to get a better look over the other children who were now standing too, Emma saw that it was the big kind of bag, the one that cost $2 at Million Dollar Deli. The disparity of their desserts was beyond anything Emma could have imagined. Blinking back tears, she put a raisin in her mouth, chewed, and swallowed, repeating the process until the gross, sticky box was empty. Her disgust rendered bearable by the feeling that struck in situations of unfairness, a feeling that her life was a movie and the audience was God, and a faith in knowing her grace and fortitude in this moment would not go unnoticed. At Winthrop, parents, specifically mothers, were expected to volunteer at various school functions, something that never would have happened during Laura's era. She signed up for the book fair. The day of the event, Emma woke up with a fever, and Laura wondered if this meant she could get out of it. As a single parent, it seemed like a valid excuse, but would it mean she'd be reassigned to the Strawberry Shortcake Festival, in which volunteers were expected to wear festive hats and aprons? It wasn't worth the risk. She bundled Emma up and delivered her to 136 so Sandra could watch her, and then headed back uptown to report for her shift. Stepping into the gymnasium, Laura was relieved the event fell on a day Emma was absent. She was appalled to discover that in addition to books, the fair included tables full of the kind of junk that was marketed to young children. Disney coloring books, Care Bear placemats, stickers featuring meaninglessly extravagant positive affirmations, special kid, A number one, the sky is the limit, you are the best. Most upsetting were the dolls and stuffed animals whose cartoonish likenesses to various beloved characters from children's literature, Curious George, Winnie the Pooh, Dear Old Eloise, struck Laura as sacrilegious. She had promised to buy Emma a new book at the fair, but she couldn't bring herself to support this kind of shameless marketing event. On her way to 136 to retrieve Emma, she stopped at the corner bookstore, where she'd been a loyal customer for years and was friendly with the staff. As Laura opened the front door, she looked forward to telling whoever was on duty about the table full of junk at the book fair. They would surely share her opinion, but the man who greeted her wasn't a face she knew.
"Welcome," he said from behind the counter. "Can I help you find something?"
Oh, no, Laura told him. I know where everything is. I've been coming here for years. The attendant clearly hadn't been trained in the ways of the corner bookstore, which was to leave customers alone.
Are you looking for anything particular today? He asked, hovering by Laura in the kids' section.
Just a book for my 6-year-old.
These are very popular.
He gestured to a display table featuring a collection of books about professionally talented children with real photographs. A very young rider, a very young dancer, a very young gymnast, a very young circus flyer, and a very young actress. After picking one of the books up, Laura promptly put it back down. Emma needed no help when it came to nursing grandiose visions of her future, which already included the Olympics and the Nutcracker. Laura continued to survey her options, but the man's solicitous shadowy presence made it impossible for her to concentrate on finding something for Emma. Eventually, she gave up and bought The Little House. They already owned a copy, but she would give it to Stephanie, who'd just announced she was pregnant. Laura hadn't known her great-uncle Bert in a personal way. His service was dry and impersonal, and when she'd asked her parents about him as they drove to the cemetery, Bibbs had summed him up as a jerk and an anti-Semite, and Douglas had affirmed this with his silence. The cemetery was adjacent to a golf course in the Connecticut suburb where Bert had moved with his third and final wife, who'd ended up leaving him for a local politician. About 2 dozen relatives had now been gathered for nearly 40 minutes around the plot of earth where Bert was to be buried. It was only 1 o'clock, but the late October light cast a brassy glaze over everything, and this made it seem more like 3 or 4. They were cold and hungry, restless and bored, but there was no going anywhere until the hearse arrived. That it was late made no sense. It had been the first vehicle to pull out of the church parking lot, then raced ahead to make a yellow light, losing the rest of the procession. Where it was now was anyone's guess. Emma kept herself entertained by crawling around digging in the dirt. Her dress would have permanent grass stains, but that was a small price to pay for the miracle of her not complaining or creating a scene. When a full hour had passed, Douglas tapped Laura on the shoulder.
"We're going to quietly take off," he whispered. "Your mother is feeling faint with hunger and fatigue."
"I think that would be a little selfish of us," Laura whispered back, "considering no one wants to be here." Douglas didn't dispute this, but discreetly gestured toward Bibbs, who was walking with strident conviction toward the car.
"I'll try to reason with her," Laura said. By the time she caught up to her mother, Bibbs was opening the passenger side door.
"We're leaving," she said, climbing in. "That's that, end of story, and don't try to talk him out of it."
"I think it's a little rude for the four of us to bow out now," Laura said, holding the door ajar. Bibbs rubbed her pearls between her fingers.
"That's why we decided you and Emma will stay on," she said, putting on her dark glasses. "You can take the train home."
"I see," Laura said.
"Dickie will drop you off at the station," Douglas said as he approached. "The train comes 24 minutes after the hour, every hour. Let me give you some cash for the tickets."
"I have cash," Laura said meekly as Douglas pulled out his wallet. She did, enough for 2 train tickets, though not enough, she realized, to stop for dinner at Jackson Hole on the way home as she'd promised Emma as part of a deal they'd struck the night before, in exchange for her coming to Connecticut. Douglas held out a $100 bill. When Laura looked reluctant to take it, he licked his finger and procured another.
"Oh, don't be such a Puritan," Bibbs said, when Laura shook her head and slid her hands into her pockets.
"I insist you take this," Douglas said,
looking genuinely cross when Laura continued to hold her ground.
"Darling," Bibbs tried softening her tone. "It's not fair to make us abandon you up here with no money."
Laura's instinct to diffuse, appease, indulge, and absolve did not kick in. Her resolve only hardened. To refuse the money was to withhold what her parents expected in exchange,
something Laura so readily and routinely provided that she was unaware it had any currency. But in this moment, it felt like the most valuable thing she had. The only thing she had.
"I have plenty of cash to get us home," Laura told her parents. "You should get going. Don't worry about us. We'll be fine."
She turned around and strolled back to resume her spot in the faithful vigil around the gaping hole.
"Mom," Emma shuffled over on her knees, cupping something in her hands. "Do you have a jar?"
"A jar," Laura repeated. "Why, yes, I have lots of jars in my pocket. What size would you like?"
"Doesn't matter," Emma said. "Long as it has a lid."
"I was kidding," Laura told Emma as she waited expectantly. "What do you think I am, a kitchen cupboard?" Laura was rarely sarcastic with Emma and immediately felt guilty. But Emma looked more concerned than hurt.
"What am I supposed to do with these worms?" she said with a labored sigh.
At long last, the hearse was spotted in the distance. The driveway was long and winding, and as the vehicle snaked its way toward them, Emma tugged Laura's sleeve and whispered,
"Guess what their names are?"
Laura drew a finger to her lips.
"You can tell me later," she mouthed. "Pee and poo," Emma whispered.
Laura ignored her.
"Mom, did you hear me?" Emma asked a little more loudly. "I said their names are Pee and Poo."
Laura leaned down.
"That's very amusing," she whispered in Emma's ear. "But we need to be quiet now, like you were in church."
Emma's face brightened.
"Mom, you think it's inappropriate, but it's Pee as in the letter P and Poo as in Winnie the Pooh."
She giggled, pleased with her cleverness. The hearse parked, and the casket was brought out and gently lowered into the cavity of earth. To everyone's distress, it would not go down. The hole wasn't big enough. The casket was placed on the grass, and there was a hushed conference among the pallbearers, who were joined by a graveyard employee who pulled out his walkie-talkie. Moments later, a bulldozer appeared at the top of the hill and barreled down at a speed Laura didn't know bulldozers were capable of, certainly not one that was legal, weaving between the stones and monuments with the implausible grace of a figure skater. The group took a wary step back as the bulldozer advanced in their direction. It stopped with a violent jerk, and its claw snapped into action, frantically digging to make the hole bigger and scattering dirt in the process. After a few minutes, the bulldozer backed up, and the casket was lowered once again. There was a collective sigh of relief as it went in, followed by a sucking in of breath. The box was in, but it was not going down, not all the way. The pallbearers attempted to lift it back up so that the bulldozer could expand the hole more, but it was now too tightly lodged in the hole.
"It's a cork-in-the-bottle situation," someone muttered.
Ceremonious pretense suspended while they awaited resolution of the logistical dilemma, the funeral-goers began chatting. The driver of the bulldozer stepped out, conferred with the pallbearers, and made an authoritative hand gesture signaling everyone should take a step back. The group fell silent and did as instructed, and the bulldozer roared back to life. This time, the driver angled the claw so that it was like the back of a hand, palm side up, and made it come down upon the casket. At first gingerly, and then not so gingerly, the claw pushed the casket down into the hole. It was not the visual one thought of in conjunction with the phrase, "laid to rest." Tugging the hem of Laura's coat, Emma articulated what everyone was thinking.
"He's gonna break it," she squealed. "Mama, he's gonna break it."
"No, he's not," Laura whispered, holding a finger over her mouth. Miraculously, he didn't. When, at last, the coffin was in the ground, there was a tentative smattering of applause, followed by an even more inappropriate "Hooray!" the echo of which rang louder in everyone's ears as it was immediately followed by chagrined silence. Laura's thoughts drifted to a PBS special she'd once seen about how Eskimos handled the whole business of death. Rather than tending to the comfort of their dying elders, they put them on a chunk of ice and watched as they drifted out to sea. Where and when had she seen this?
She couldn't remember now. Perhaps it wasn't a documentary after all, but an article in National Geographic she'd conjured up in such vivid detail that she recalled it now as footage in a film. Or maybe it was a tall tale she'd heard as a child. Either way, it had made an impression on her. She'd thought it was the strangest thing. But what about the scene that was unfolding right now? She was very much one of them, but this didn't stop Laura from recognizing that her people, they were weird.
Laura's mother wanted to invite Dr. Brown to join them for Thanksgiving.
"Let me think about it," Laura said. "I'm not asking for your permission," Bibbs told her. "I'm asking for his phone number."
Laura sighed. "Dinner is one thing, a family holiday is another. I just don't know if it's appropriate."
"If you won't give me his number, the operator will," Bibbs said and hung up. 15 minutes later, she called back. "Guess who's coming to Thanksgiving?" Her triumphant voice chimed through the receiver. "He's very excited. He asked what he should bring, and I told him nothing. And he said he didn't like the idea of me in the kitchen doing everything. And I said, I didn't either. That's why we get it catered."
An hour later, the phone rang again, and this time it was Dr. Brown.
"Your mother invited me to Thanksgiving," he said.
"I know, I'm sorry. She can be very persistent. I hope she didn't bully you into saying yes."
Dr. Brown laughed. "You're making it sound like she asked me to donate a kidney."
"It's not too late to back out."
"Laura, will you relax? I wouldn't have said yes if I didn't want to."
Laura was silent. The way he'd said her name, the demand to relax, made her smile. He'd completely shed the veneer of their professional relationship. This had been happening in degrees for some time, but now it was really gone. He was very fond of her, and she of him. And here they were on the phone together talking about Thanksgiving. Catching a glimpse of herself in the mirror, Laura noticed she was blushing and twirling the phone cord in her finger, and she blushed even harder, imagining him watching her do this right now.
"I want to come, and I'm coming," Dr. Brown said. "My question for you is, do you think it would be okay if I brought my partner?"
"Dr. Wendell?" Laura was confused.
"No," Dr. Brown said. "Not that partner."
Bibbs, who appreciated all male company, especially the tall and handsome kind, couldn't have looked more excited when Dr. Brown introduced her to Chris. Sherry was served, ginger ale for Emma, and they all took a seat in the living room. Douglas began to ask Chris about his work, but before their conversation could go anywhere, Bibbs interrupted to ask the guests if they believed in ghosts. Neither had a chance to answer. Bibbs launched into a story about a friend of hers whose first husband, long dead, had visited her in a dream to tell her the new husband was a philanderer, and the very next day, the cleaning lady found a brassiere tucked beneath the cushions of his study. Could they believe it? Wasn't that the most absolutely bizarre thing they'd ever heard? Chris made an effort to match Bibbs's animated incredulity, indulging her with questions. He was not what Laura had expected. His Hollywood good looks surprised her, as did the fact that he worked on Wall Street. She would have thought Dr. Brown would have chosen someone in a more ethical profession, someone more soft-spoken and bashfully reserved, like himself. Emma, too, seemed taken aback by this man. Uncharacteristically quiet, she retreated to a corner of the room with her coloring book, periodically looking up to cast an appraising glance in his direction. Soon it was time to eat, and they filed into the dining room. As Sandra circulated the table with platters of food, Bibbs regaled her guests with one colorful anecdote after the next, all grossly exaggerated for comic effect. Laura winced each time Chris's baritone laughter shook the room, wishing her father would speak up, as he sometimes did in these situations, warning guests that this was like putting a quarter in her. She'd keep going. They'd better have another 15 minutes.
"I adore homosexuals, and they adore me," Bibbs said with a smug grin after the couple left.
"What's a homosexual?" Emma asked on their way home.
Laura considered her answer before deciding Emma was too young. I don't know, she said. Must be one of Bibbs' made-up words. The following week, Laura was on the phone with her mother when Bibbs casually mentioned having made plans with Dr. Brown to go see a play that night. Laura was surprised her mother hadn't thought to include her.
But, darling, you hate the theater.
Last time I took you, you fell asleep.
I was 8 months pregnant, Laura reminded her.
Well, I'm sorry, I only got 3 tickets. Next time, I'll get 4.
3 tickets? But Daddy's the one who really hates the theater.
Don't be a dummy, her mother laughed. Of course I'm not bringing that old Philistine boar. The 3rd ticket is for Bruno.
Bruno? Who's Bruno? Laura asked.
Dr. Brown's lover.
The term is partner, not lover. And that's not even his name. It's Chris.
I know, but he's such a Bruno, isn't he? Bibbs said.
Laura wasn't able to take off work for Stephanie's baby shower, but she and Emma paid her a visit the following weekend to hand-deliver their present.
Hopefully no one got this for you already, Laura said, presenting Stephanie with the book. It's called The Little House. Have you heard of it?
Stephanie shook her head and smiled.
It's a classic, been around since my childhood, Laura said. Do you remember Marge used to read it to us, Nicholas?
Stephanie held the book up for him to see. Nicholas looked up, squinted, shook his head, and returned to his Wall Street Journal.
Anyway, Laura continued, it's about this little house in the country that gets sad when the beautiful meadows that surround it are gradually destroyed by developers, who erect high-rises and turn the countryside into a city.
Never too early for kids to learn about urban sprawl, Nicholas said dryly.
Don't worry, Laura told Stephanie. Eventually, the house gets bought and the new owners have it lifted off its foundation and relocated to the country.
Stephanie nodded but looked puzzled.
So the book has a happy ending, Laura clarified.
Oh, Stephanie said. Well, I see it won an award, she added, fingering a gold sticker on the cover.
It wasn't a custom in their family to name sons after their fathers, but Stephanie was adamant, and in March, she gave birth to Nicholas Jr. Emma was so excited she convinced Laura to let her take the morning off from school so they could visit the baby in the hospital.
I hope we aren't bothering you, Laura said, holding Emma's hand as they peered into Stephanie's room. We'll only stay for a few minutes.
Infant asleep in her arms, Stephanie looked up, a dazed smile on her face. Emma tugged Laura forward to get a closer look.
Baby Nicholas, Laura said, taking a seat in the chair beside Stephanie's bed.
We can't tell who he looks like yet, Stephanie said, tucking a lock of hair behind her ear.
Stray wisps had come loose, and as they caught the light, they formed an ethereal halo around her face, which Laura had never seen without makeup. She had the porcelain complexion of a redhead, though she was more strawberry blonde, and her cheeks bore a youthful dusting of freckles. Stephanie's eyelashes were also strawberry blonde, Laura observed for the first time, as they were typically caked with mascara. As sisters-in-law, it was inevitable they would get closer over the years. Laura looked forward to the day she could tell Stephanie what a mistake she'd been making, that to wear makeup was to mar her natural, delicate beauty, and she looked 100 times better without it. Then she would bring Stephanie to Sofrina to get her lashes done. Stephanie asked if Laura wanted to hold the baby, and Laura said she would, but not now, as he looked so peaceful and she didn't want to disturb him.
Don't worry, Stephanie said, passing the swaddled bundle of him over.
It had been a while since she'd held an infant. Laura adjusted her position so that the baby's head rested in the crook of her arm. At one point, his face scrunched up in an expression of discomfort, but this quickly passed, and once he'd settled back into a tranquil slumber, Laura's guilt and anxiety for having taken him away from his mother subsided. She allowed herself to enjoy the cozy tingling
where the warmth of his little body rested against hers.
"Look at him," Laura said in a whisper.
Emma leaned over the arm of the chair, scrutinizing his face.
"He looks Chinese," she remarked.
"Those lashes," Laura said almost wistfully.
"He hardly has any hair," Emma observed.
"Actually, he has quite a bit of hair for a newborn," Laura said.
"As much as I did?"
"You had a little more," Laura conceded.
"How much more?"
Laura held up her free hand and created a modest space between pointer finger and thumb.
"That smell," Laura said, inhaling his scalp.
"I know," Stephanie smiled. "Isn't it the best?"
"There's nothing like it," Laura agreed.
Emma leaned in for a sniff.
"Smells like yogurt," she said, plugging her nose.
The baby yawned, and Laura's heart did a little cartwheel. Her previous trips to the maternity ward to visit friends had not been like this. She'd had to pretend to have the reaction she was having right now.
"Yo-yo, Ma," Emma poked Laura's shoulder. "Would you please take me to school before I get in trouble for missing gymnastics?"
"Okay," Laura said, "but give me a few more minutes with this baby."
"What the heck is that for?" Emma asked, pointing to a medical contraption on the wall.
Laura looked up with a frown and shook her head. Stephanie put on a pair of tortoiseshell glasses and shrugged. Emma let out a dispirited sigh and wandered over to the window. Pressing her face against the glass, she took a deep breath, wrote her initials in the cloud of condensation, and drew a heart around them. On their way out, they bumped into Nicholas, who'd been on a Zabar's run, and Laura felt moved to convey her feelings about his baby, how the affection she had felt was much deeper than anything she'd felt for her friends' infants, that it was particular to this one. She'd expected his face to light up with paternal pride, but instead he looked mildly annoyed.
"Well, he's not a friend's baby," he said, pressing the elevator button. "He's your nephew."
Nicholas and Stephanie's apartment was only a few blocks from the library, and recalling how isolating the first year of motherhood could be, Laura made a habit of dropping by when Stephanie was alone there during the day. With the hope of cultivating a more casual, more familial relationship with her sister-in-law, Laura wouldn't call beforehand. She'd just show up. Occasionally, she brought food, but most of the time she arrived empty-handed. Due to the frequency of these impromptu visits, the doormen came to recognize Laura and would send her straight up without buzzing to let Stephanie know she had a guest. Stephanie, however, clung to a certain sense of protocol and was often flustered when she opened the door, apologizing for her appearance, for not having anything for Laura to eat, for the state of the apartment. Laura was never hungry and would insist that the apartment and Stephanie looked fine. In the beginning, Stephanie appeared sweetly disheveled, and the apartment, once so immaculately kept it felt sterile, now had an air of homey disarray. But as the weeks went by, Laura began to notice things that left her troubled. Dirty dishes haphazardly perched in odd places, mounds of unfolded laundry tucked behind oversized couch cushions, a stack of starchy Christmas cocktail napkins on the back of the toilet in lieu of toilet paper. They'd received a lot of flowers after arriving home from the hospital, and as they began to expire, they released a vaguely fecal odor. More than anything, Laura wanted to go through the apartment and restore order, but she suspected that even offering to do so would stoke Stephanie's shame over the condition of things, and so she resisted the urge. The visits usually only lasted about 15 minutes, and Laura did most of the talking. One afternoon, she was waiting in the checkout line of Associated Value when she noticed Princess Diana on the cover of a tabloid newspaper. The headline suggested the royal couple was headed for a divorce. She was shocked and wondered if Stephanie knew. It would be fertile conversational fodder, and she studied the questions beneath the headline so that she could put them to Stephanie. What would happen to Charles? Could he still be king? Would he ever marry again? What would Di do? Where would she live? Would she ever be allowed to see her kids? Later that evening, in the middle of putting Emma to bed, the phone rang. It was Nicholas, calling to say Stephanie was feeling overwhelmed. "Of course she is," Laura said,
touched that he was confiding in her. She told Nicholas that she had a meeting scheduled the next morning and an appointment in the afternoon, but she would be more than happy to cancel one or both of them to come over and help out. She could bring groceries, run errands, watch the baby so Stephanie could go out and get a haircut, whatever she could do to make life easier for Stephanie. Nicholas told her not to cancel the appointments, that it would be better, actually, if she didn't come by tomorrow, or quite so often, as Stephanie found it difficult to entertain while taking care of a newborn, especially when guests dropped by unannounced.
I see, Laura said after a pause.
I know you're just trying to help, he said. I hope this doesn't hurt your feelings.
Not at all, Laura told her brother. She knew better than to allow it to upset her. The problem was Stephanie's. She needed to let down her guard, to figure out how to relax and be comfortable around people. It would be childish for Laura to take it personally. Depression was an illness, and Laura felt for anyone who suffered from it, but there was something about the modifier, postpartum, that she wrestled with. The concept seemed vaguely Victorian, and she wondered about its scientific credibility. In any case, Laura felt terrible for Stephanie, but also vindicated. This explained Stephanie's reaction to her visits. There was no need to feel foolish or guilty about having come over so often. It was Bibbs who called to let Laura know Stephanie had been admitted to the hospital. Laura didn't want to bother Nicholas, so she called 136 for updates. Laura had never heard of such a thing as a private psychiatric facility that had a specific program catering to mothers suffering from PPD, but apparently one existed, in northern Westchester, and after a few nights at Columbia Presbyterian, Stephanie went there.
It's the best, Bibbs said, the way she spoke about restaurants and hotels.
They were completely booked, but Bibbs' longtime therapist, Dr. Clark, had made some calls and gotten Stephanie a room. Every Friday after work, Nicholas, who'd never learned to drive, took the train up to visit his wife and child. This went on for 5 weeks, and Laura was starting to worry. Finally, Bibbs called to say that Stephanie was doing much better and scheduled to be discharged that coming Friday. Laura dialed Nicholas at the office and offered to drive him up to get her so that they wouldn't have to take the train back. In keeping with the trend of the last decade, it had been a prematurely warm spring. It was not yet June, and the punitive humidity of summer was already upon them. The newspaper predicted today's high would be 94 degrees, a new record for this date. By 9 a.m., a fuzzy yellow haze had already descended upon the city, obscuring the horizon and enshrouding the tops of skyscrapers like tufts of steel wool. Stepping outside felt like entering the tropical bird section of the zoo. Rarely a day went by when Laura didn't think about the greenhouse effect, and on days like this, rarely an hour. The parking garage on 103rd Street was only a few minutes from Laura's apartment, but walking there in the heat, with Nicholas, it felt much longer. He didn't say anything, but she could sense his disapproval that she would keep her car in Harlem. People didn't believe Laura when she told them how little she spent on parking, $100 a month. She wanted to share this figure with Nicholas, but being ignorant of the cost of keeping a car in the city, he wouldn't be impressed. As they waited to cross 101st, something transpired that made Laura question whether the saved money was worth it. For the last block or so, she'd been aware of the encroaching presence of what sounded like a group of teenage boys behind them. Apart from the occasional profanity, their rowdy, slangy banter was beyond Laura's comprehension, though it put her on edge. As she and Nicholas waited for the light to turn, the group caught up to them, and Laura felt a hand on her bottom. The thin cotton fabric of her skirt was a flimsy barrier between the sweaty compress of the groper's palm and her own skin, which hadn't completely dried after getting out of the bath that morning. Nicholas was either oblivious or shared Laura's instinct that the best thing to do was avoid creating a scene. Too scared to turn and see who was touching her, Laura stood perfectly still and pretended nothing was happening. When the light turned and the hand let go, a trio of adolescent boys on bicycles rolled off the curb. They couldn't have been more than 12 or 13 years old. Their bikes were much too small for them.
Laura felt a mix of fury and sorrow as she watched them pedal on, knees bent out at awkward angles. Turning the car's AC on was like opening the door of an oven. "It takes a few minutes for it to get cool," Laura explained, adjusting the vents to direct the air away from them. "While we wait for that to happen, we can drive with the windows down."
"AC and open windows," Nicholas said with phony excitement. "How frivolous."
"I admire people who never learned how to drive," she told him. "Given the impact of automobiles on the planet, it must feel nice to know that you're not contributing to that problem." It made her feel better to say this, knowing how much it would irritate him since he refused to believe in global warming.
"I can drive," Nicholas said. "I simply prefer not to."
Neither of them spoke for a while after that. Laura worried she'd gone too far. Perhaps he felt emasculated that he wasn't able to retrieve his wife and infant on his own. Her thoughts drifted to an afternoon more than 3 decades ago. Bibbs had been away at Seven Oaks, summer camp for grown-ups, as it was explained to Laura and Nicholas. It was her first of what would be several stints there, and the only time that Douglas had taken the two of them to go see her. The four of them had had a picnic outside and gone for a walk to a pond. When it was time to say goodbye to their mother, Nicholas, who was just 5 years old, didn't want to leave. Douglas had to carry him, kicking and screaming, to the car, and as they drove back to the city, his howling continued.
"That'll be enough, Nicholas," Douglas kept saying. "You're giving me a headache."
At a certain point, their father couldn't take it anymore and pulled over with a violent jerk on the shoulder of the highway.
"Enough," he barked. "Enough, enough, enough."
To see their father, who was normally so composed like this, was very upsetting. Someone at Seven Oaks had given them a balloon in the shape of an animal. Nicholas had been clutching it in his lap, and now he squeezed it with such force it popped. First the head, then the tail, then the torso. He started crying even harder. Douglas glanced at Laura.
"You must calm him down," he pleaded, an angry, desperate look on his face. "I simply cannot drive like this."
Laura was at a loss for how to handle the situation. She felt like someone had taken a spoon and scooped out the inside of her chest, as one does a pumpkin to make a jack-o'-lantern. As they continued to sit there on the side of the Bronx River Parkway, their station wagon rattling in the turbulence of cars whizzing by, it started to rain. A sharp, prickly, slanted rain that landed on the windows in jarring splats. It was as though a curtain had been pulled back, and something terribly ugly had been revealed, and nothing would ever feel the same. They could never go back to how it was, to how life was supposed to be, because it had never really been that way. Everything up to that point had been a game of make-believe. When they reached the Sawmill River Parkway, Nicholas asked if she had a nail clipper. Laura said she might have one in her purse. She'd check at the next light.
"Never mind," he said, picking one of Emma's barrettes off the floor, which he used to extract the dirt from beneath his nails.
Laura asked if he'd made any special plans for Stephanie's homecoming. Indeed he had. Tea at the plaza, a horse and carriage ride through Central Park, dinner at the boathouse, all of her favorite New York things to do.
"Assuming she's up for it, of course," Nicholas added.
"I'm sure it will make her very happy," Laura said. When they got off the exit, she asked, "Right or left?"
"Right," Nicholas said.
Laura put on her blinker, but as they approached the end of the ramp, he changed his answer.
"Left?" she repeated. "Right," he said with conviction.
"You mean correct, go left, or take a right?" Nicholas, who'd inherited their mother's geographic dyslexia, held up both hands to make L's with his thumb and pointer fingers, a trick to discern left from right, which Laura had recently tried to teach Emma, who was already demonstrating signs of being similarly challenged.
"Go this way," he said, tapping the passenger side window.
After she made the turn, Nicholas casually mentioned that he didn't know the directions from the highway.
"Just drive to the village where the train station is," he instructed. "I'll know where to go from there."
A mile later, no sign of a village, Laura pulled into a gas station that was also a general store to ask for directions. Stepping out of the car, Laura's simmering frustration with Nicholas abated. The air smelled like warm gravel and honeysuckle. The country heat felt less apocalyptic, more recreational. The husky pulse of insects and the mindless twitter of birds had a pacifying effect. We could move here, she thought, walking toward the store's entrance. She envisioned a modest house with a front porch and a wood stove. They would buy a rake and a snow shovel, learn how to grow a vegetable garden and compost their leftovers. Each morning, Laura would stand in the driveway and wave goodbye as a yellow school bus shuttled Emma to the public school, where her classmates would be the children of the local shopkeepers, plumbers, and policemen. Growing up, the children would spend time in one another's house, which in a town like this people called a home. And the two of them wouldn't be known by their family name, but simply as Laura and Emma. A lifelong problem Laura had when receiving directions from strangers. So much energy went into smiling and nodding to convey her appreciation for their assistance that she struggled to retain what they told her. The man behind the counter had made it sound very easy, however, and Laura did exactly what she'd been told. But Nicholas objected to the final turn, claiming he did not remember the driveway being so rustic. Laura thought it made sense for a psychiatric institution to have a driveway like this, long, unpaved, woodsy, and narrow. It created a sense of remove, discouraged the casual flow of traffic, generated the impression of being safely sequestered from the cold curiosity of those for whom places like this existed only in movies or as the punchline of jokes.
Nope, doesn't look right, Nicholas kept saying.
It has to be, Laura insisted, though she too was starting to have doubts. The farther up this driveway they drove, the unrulier it got. Sticks cracked and popped beneath their tires, and bushes brushed against the windows like curtains of a car wash.
I will say, this driveway is awfully narrow, Laura said, coming to a stop.
She put the car in park, unbuckled her seatbelt, turned the ignition off, and opened her door. Stepping outside, she noticed that the only tire treads on the ground were behind them. What lay ahead of the path they were on appeared to be unblemished. A sylvan green light filtered down through the canopy of leaves, creating the sense of a room.
I think we may have made a wrong turn, Laura conceded, getting back in.
It looks like this isn't technically a road, but some sort of hiking trail, or a private path that cuts through someone's property. Laura explained that there wasn't enough room to do a 3-point turn, which meant they'd have to reverse all the way out. Nicholas nodded, chewing the inside of his lip. She sensed that he was very frustrated, that he wished he'd just taken the train. But Laura refused to feel guilty. She had volunteered to do a nice thing. Nicholas should have thought ahead and come prepared with directions from the highway.
Backing up has never been my forte, Laura warned as she put her seatbelt back on, but I'll do my best.
Putting the car in reverse, she twisted around and gingerly lifted her foot off the brake. When the car didn't move, she gently pressed down on the accelerator. It was difficult to manipulate the rear wheels to make the car's progression adhere to the trail, which was not straight. They'd gone a few yards before they came up against a tree.
Whoops-a-daisy, Laura said, adjusting the wheels and putting the car back in drive.
She proceeded to give the accelerator a series of tentative taps. They were on an incline, so each tap of the accelerator would take them a few inches forward, and then they'd roll a couple of inches back.
At this rate, we should be back on the road by tomorrow, Nicholas remarked.
Do you want to give it a try? She asked, craning her neck around to see out the back.
You know, I never thought about it before, but of all the New Yorkers I know who never got around to learning how to drive, or simply prefer not to, they're almost all men.
It's interesting, and I don't think it's a coincidence, she continued.
Learning to drive requires a certain humility, and then there's the additional humiliation of being late to the game. When it became obvious that reversing their way back out was hopeless, Laura pursued their only other option, which was to go forward and hope for the best. The woods eventually ended, but the path continued onto a field of tall grass, which brought them to the foot of a freshly mown lawn. At the other end of which sat a house. Laura slowly nosed the car out of the field and onto this lawn. She paused before proceeding. There was a car parked in the driveway next to the house, I wonder what the people who live in that house are going to think when they see a car driving through their backyard, she said.
I imagine they'll be a bit surprised, Nicholas said, and not so happy.
Well, how else do I get us